Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everybody. Welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. My name's Josh. I'm an entrepreneur. And on today's show, this is going to be a special show because we have some really cool people in studio with us. We have the co-founder, David Brim, who started Orlando Entrepreneurs to be the hub for entrepreneurship here. And we have one of his favorite people. So I'm going to let David do the intro to Miss Lillian.
Absolutely. We're thrilled to have Lillian Myers join us today. Lillian is a friend and mentor that I've had for about 12 years now. I met her at the University of Central Florida Venture Lab, and she's taught me so much. She's an exceptional marketer, entrepreneur, strategist, and coach, and she's currently the co-founder of Economy 4. So Lillian, welcome to the show.
Hi, David. Hi, Josh. It's so nice to be here. I really appreciate you asking me to be on the show.
Absolutely. So can you talk to us about your journey to Orlando, how long you've been here, and how you got started here?
Oh, wow. Orlando. So I came to Orlando in 1985, and I arrived here with a baby and a suitcase from Istanbul, Turkey. And my parents had moved here to Orlando. And it was an interesting place to transition to and start life over again.
Did you grow up in Istanbul?
No, I did not grow up in Istanbul. I grew up all over the southeast of the United States and sometime in San Francisco, which is where I met a man from Istanbul and married him.
Ah.
and off I went to Turkey.
So when you got back to Orlando, what was your next step in your professional journey?
Find a job. That was starter. And that was where technology started. You know, my whole technology world started because my father pushed across the desk to me a brand new Macintosh, like one of the original 1984 Macs, and said, here, figure this out. You'll be able to get a job.
Wow.
Okay. So sit in front of a Mac. Like, where did you even begin? Because like the older computers, you know, like really weren't really user-friendly. So what was your first approach into that? And then how did that kind of lead you into your first J-O-B? We'd love to hear that story.
Yeah, my first J-O-B that had anything to do with technology had to do with drawing weapon slings and things like that for DOD contractors' manuals in Orlando, because there was a lot of that going on here at the time. There still clearly is, but that was the starting point, using Adobe Illustrator on a Mac, because it had nothing to do with computers. It had to do with drawing pictures, and I could do that. So there you go. So that was the beginning, but it ultimately, that understanding of how to use that device and then how to use Microsoft products on that device, which back in the day were Microsoft Office for the Mac, most people don't know, in the late 80s, was where Microsoft made its profits. And so the fact that I could use it meant I was doing consulting for small businesses around using AppleTalk networks, doing these little micro networks to automate and write macros in Excel and Word. That got me recruited by Microsoft, and that's where my technology career began.
At Microsoft in the early days, huh?
In the early days, yeah. Here in Orlando as a reseller rep initially, because I was taking little clients into, like, right down the street from your office here used to be a big reseller called Inicom computers, and literally they sold hardware and software to companies. And in the day, I was dragging companies into those resellers saying, here, you need to buy 5 Macs and 5 copies of Microsoft Office, and here's what you'll do, and we'll connect all that together, and here's how you'll run your little small business. So that reputation among resellers in the area is what got me recruited by Microsoft, and that was the beginning of technology for me.
So how did your experience at Microsoft and this initial role you had evolve and grow, and then talk to us about how you transitioned from Microsoft into doing your own business.
Well, that was a really interesting story. And I think, like a lot of entrepreneurs, you start with an inspiration. You start with something that drives you, something that you care about passionately. And for me, in that moment in time, so nearly 5 years later at Microsoft, my mother died. And she was 55, and it was a cancer that was misdiagnosed kind of routinely because she lived between two different cities. And so it was very late stage by the time that they caught it. And what I knew working at Microsoft at that point, well beyond the reseller channel, I was in the working in a group that was about bringing software developers, independent software vendors, onto Microsoft's then very early stage back office platform, so SQL Server, Windows NT, those things, and saying, okay, refocus your energy working with them on building business plans, go-to-market strategies for new client server. Oh boy, those were such big words back in those days, let me just tell you. Client server technologies and platforms and converting them sort of evangelically to what Microsoft platforms could do for them versus, say, IBM AS400s and some of the kinds of systems that they were building back in those days. So this was really new thinking. But my mom got sick and she died. And what I knew was that and healthcare was one of my vertical industries. So I started working with kind of off the side of my desk, a group of folks here in Orlando who were doing a Skunkworks early electronic health record technology. And I was passionate about it because what I knew is that they were rolling out a technology into multiple clinics, hundreds of doctors, that was about docs being able to communicate about what a patient's health was and being able to diagnose and solve much earlier. So these were among the smartest people I knew, and they actually won what was... you know, again, we'll go back in the day here. We'll roll back in history a little bit. And there was a time when there was a big technology show that was like CES today, but it was for computers and it was called Comdex. And what happened at Comdex every year was every vendor of hardware and software showed up and said, look, this is all that. And Microsoft at that point, those were the early Windows days, right? So Microsoft started this kind of subgroup called Windows World at Comdex. And that year at Comdex, there was a competition called Windows World Open. It was 1993, Windows World Open. And these guys here in Orlando won Windows World Open. Like, you know, walk across the stage, Bill G, that's what we call him, Bill G, because that's what we all, that was our email alias, you know, like Lillian M.
$1 billion Bill.
Well, not then. Yeah. We were still working on making a half a billion, like we hadn't even gotten to $500 million a year in revenue at that point. It was like a little company. And Windows World Open. And so it's like, oh my gosh, this is so important and so serious. And they won it because they could, on a dial-up line, and the person that responsible for that, I'll have to tell you, his name is David Greenberg, and he's a fantastic human. On a dial-up line from the floor of Comdex, or from the stage of Comdex, dialed up to a server here in Orlando and pulled a patient record, a dummy patient record. But it was like a first ever. It was really incredible to be able to say that a patient record could be seen from a distance, even over what we had
that
in those days.
The birth of the whole EMR industry that's just
booming, and it's booming all over the world. So that was, as I was helping these guys, because they were neither, for Microsoft, they were neither a corporate account, nor were they a startup, nor were they a vertical software company. They were, you know, this little idea inside a big HMO, a large group practice, working on what are we going to do next. So working on their business plan with them voluntarily was the moment of truth. Was, Lillian, would you come do this with us? We're really going to start this. Would you leave Microsoft and come do this with us? And I was like, wow, what a tough decision that was in those days. Those were, you know, that was when working for Microsoft kind of gave you a personal cachet of being smart, which I was never smart like any of those people that were. I was older by far than most of my colleagues at Microsoft, and I was 30 or 32 or something like that, and most people, the average age at Microsoft in those days was mid-20s. So I was older. I was different. You know, I was a single mom. I was not, you know, I had lots of different kind of responsibilities. But you suddenly, you know, you were a part of this big, we used to call it the Borg. Yeah, I don't know if you watched the old Star Trek movies, but like single mind thing, creature, you know, single mind headed creature all over the world. And yeah, pretty arrogant. There was a reputation for that. I learned some bad habits there, which I still work on today. Like, don't be that, because it doesn't get you anywhere. But it was a very, very exciting time. So this was a moment of sort of personal reconciliation, of being able to say, what's more important to me? That, and by the way, the stock options were, wow.
I remember you telling me, too, that even the team at Microsoft would put pressure on the new hires. If somebody wasn't performing, the peer pressure, they would just want to leave due to the peer pressure, because everybody was just like, let's grow this. Everybody was excited. And also the stock options, like, things kept splitting. Everybody was making more money. So if you weren't performing, you know.
That was the conversation. Every sales meeting, you know, and we had some amazing sales meetings at places where they uninvited us to return. But, you know, it was about the stock split this year. And, you know, it was very much, it must be what it felt like to be at Google in the early years, or even now, I presume. But it was heady, and it was inspiring. We really, you know, felt like we were changing the world. But when I looked at the problems of healthcare and what had happened for my mom, and the ideas about what really did matter in the world, it seemed way less important. You know, you could suddenly put your family at risk and those kinds of things in different ways, and say, all right, this is what really matters. This is what matters for real humans. So, yeah, do you really have a choice? Not so much. So you know, an incredible team too. Amazingly smart humans, many of whom I'm still very, very close to today in all kinds of ways. Personal and professional ways. Quite an experience.
Gotcha. So how did that all shake out after you joined the team?
Well, let's see. So it was a fascinating growth path. We were, you know, kind of all in over our heads. I think you learned that the first time around, that all the things you don't know. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, a saying around there in those days. For one of my still very dear friends, when you don't know what you don't know. And that's when you start sorting out, you know, what this team is comprised of, and what you actually need, what you need to go recruit, and you start looking for the things that you really need. And we found some amazing, extraordinary people that we really, really needed, but it got us through. And some of those people, I guess it's okay for me to say who they are. Some of those people include folks like Thad Seymour, who came on as our president, who...
current president of UCF right now.
Yeah, he is, and an extraordinary human. There's nobody's ever met him who doesn't know he is extraordinary, but he had unbelievable capabilities around... he was running marketing at that time, he'd moved down to Orlando to run marketing for a joint venture between IBM and Baxter Healthcare that was a software technology. He came from other software technology before that, so he had great skills and experience in the domain, and he was just a godsend for us. He was also able to, you know, make those first connections for us into places and important people that were the source of our original venture capital, you know, getting contracting done that... I think we papered his office in legal contracts at one point, because he just turned into a master at that. But finding the right people and resources and moving through the phases of early investment, later stage investment, and we did have top tier Silicon Valley investors, ended up doing great partnerships with the biggest companies in the industry to help open up channels for us. There were for sure a couple of pivots in there. There probably was never not the exit there that there could have been or should have been, but it had a lot to do with understanding and interpreting how the market dynamics were changing and how quickly they were changing. But ultimately, that technology ended up with Siemens, Siemens Healthcare, and there are still people today. So that grew from, you know, five, seven people to 250 or so, and there are still a handful of people who have gone with the subsequent acquisitions of that technology and are today with the final. So it's gone through like three acquisitions since, and they're still with
the it's still alive in some form or fashion.
Yes.
What you guys created, it got gobbled up by the big boys and then kind of progressed.
Bigger boys. It just kept going on, you know, sort of bigger fish. Yeah, so it's really cool to see.
When you take what you learned working there, you left Microsoft, which you saw a lot of good things, and you got to grow with them from early years, to going to a startup and helping see that grow, exit, be acquired, and moved up the ranks. When you see that, how do you think that helps you now talk with entrepreneurs out there? So we're talking to entrepreneurs in the audience right now who are on the on the startup stage, right? So they're building. Like, how do you think that has helped you help them? And what advice do you have for them if they're getting started?
Well,
that's a lot of questions.
That's a lot to unpack right there. Well, I think, Josh, the first part is that wasn't the only startup experience. So there were subsequent ones after that.
Okay.
Company. There were a few years working on and with lots of startups to try to help them discover that you don't know what you don't know bit. Most of those, by the way, they were in Atlanta because that's where there was a lot of startup activity going on in the early 2000s, even after the internet bubble. Working here with local authorities, government, UCF, all of that sort of stuff to try to propel some of this tech startup activity here in a variety of ways, and then doing the next startup and then joining some others that were already underway, ones like Channel Intelligence that ultimately, was acquired by Google, and a whole bunch of those people are now in Pittsburgh and places like that, which is very cool. So
you've been a part of all these little that grown into big.
Yeah.
You've been a part of a lot of them.
Or that have grown into acquisition things. Yeah, so another one that I went out and did in Scottsdale, Arizona, that was around consumer health and employee health, and then the folding in of that one into another company that was, again, people, from the circle, like people who had worked with us and for us in the startup here in Orlando, that were doing a health technology in Salt Lake City, and then becoming part of that, and part of that management team, and then being acquired by Aetna. So a lot of these that are, kind of pieces and parts coming together. I think the learning, to go back to your question, which is how do you help entrepreneurs, and I think this is how the relationship started for David and me. It was sort of trying to explain where the parts fit together and how they fit together and why the people are important in thinking about what you're doing, why the market and understanding of the market becomes the most important exercise in beginning. I just came from a meeting with an early stage company a few minutes ago, and it was interesting, as a healthcare play, it was interesting to hear where they're starting in some of the things that they're doing that are, it's a category of healthcare that I've never worked in specifically, but it's interesting to hear the sort of the value proposition interpretation from those who don't come from that industry. And healthcare, boy, you can't learn any faster in healthcare than it was said 25 years ago when I first saw healthcare. And it's still true today. oh yeah, people can bring all this knowledge and domain expertise from other places, and if they just apply it to healthcare, we'll figure all this out. Well, it doesn't always work exactly like that, because there are so many dynamics in an industry that you just are not aware of until you really dig into it. That's the first thing that I say. I think that's probably the first thing that I've said to you and others, David.
Yeah, so when I met Lillian, I was a wide-eyed college student, and I stumbled into a place that said, have a business idea? Come in here. I said, what is this? And I had stumbled in, and I met Lillian. There were some other coaches there, too, and I just kind of gravitated towards Lillian. And I hate to say this publicly, but I actually used to cut class and sit with Lillian. She didn't advise that I cut class at UCF.
Oh, thank you very much for saying that.
But I learned so much more from an entrepreneur and marketer who's been there, done it, than I did from professors talking about theory, and I really resonated with her approach. She's very honest and candid, and she will tell you how it is, and I'm sure there's certain entrepreneurs that you've dealt with that don't necessarily take criticism, or maybe they're fragile. They think their idea is the best in the world, but as you know, they're not part of that market. And so if they're not part of the market, their idea, if they're thinking about it in their office, isn't the same as truly understanding the ins and outs, how it works. And that's really a lot of what I learned from you, and how to approach market entry and really digging down deep from a marketing standpoint. It's been very helpful.
Thanks for that, David. That's to see you today is, it's always humbling to hear you say things like that, so I really appreciate it. But I think what you stimulated for me there is that the real question that I ask more than anything else is why. There's no other question. Why would somebody buy it? Why does someone care? Why does this change what you think it changes? What makes you sure that that's the why? Have you really uncovered what's happening and what will happen? Because if you're tracking to something that will never happen, and you think that's your focus, and that's often what occurs, you know, like we have an idea that's inspired by something that happens for us, and we make assumptions about what that means to others. Mm-hmm. And you know, while that can work on some, I'm looking at little things on a tabletop here that are a reminder that we can invent all kinds of cool things that solve little problems, and they're probably great on many levels. But if you walk into Shark Tank, what are they going to ask you? Well, why does anybody care? Who's going to buy this? Why are they buying it? What about the competition? What makes you think you can get there? How much money will it cost to get there? How much time will it take to get you there? If you don't have any influence in that industry, how are you going to enter that market? Is it because you know and understand all those things, or is it because you presume a lot of things? Mm. And I think that that's been a hard lesson for me personally, and I've watched it be a very hard lesson for a lot of other entrepreneurs.
So with that, if we were able to kind of help others make sure that maybe that's not a stumbling block for them, David, you mentioned this thing called a fragile idea, right? So how can we see if our idea is fragile and it could be cracked with some stones? You asked a bunch of good questions. Maybe could you take me to a few of your, like, the best, most important questions that you should ask when I have an idea. There's a sign up on the door right now that says, do you have a business idea? Come in and talk with Lillian. So I came in, I sat down, I've got a bunch of ideas, right? What are some questions that we could ask, or an entrepreneur could ask, to see if your idea is fragile and it won't withstand the pressures of the marketplace? What are some ideas that you go to ask a new entrepreneur?
Well, the first thing I ask is, how does the industry work? Because if you don't understand the industry that you're stepping into, you're gonna fail for sure.
Yeah.
You have to figure out what the moving parts are. You are just another moving part. And the second question is, who's your competition? And the combination of those two usually tell me right away whether somebody gets, whether they've got a chance here or not.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's easier with a thing, like an object, that's consumer oriented than it is with an idea that's consumer oriented. For sure, consumers are, that's wow. As soon as somebody says we're going after consumers, I go, oh, okay. Well, that's an interesting one because that's big. What does that mean exactly? And how do you find them? And how do you touch them? And how do you reach them? And who else is trying to appeal to them? So competition gets to be a big one there. But if it's a specific industry like healthcare or financial services or whatever else, if you don't sort of get how that works, who's the decision maker? Who's the economic buyer? Literally, who's the influencer? If you don't understand who you're selling to and what your value proposition has to be and who's following after them and how those decisions are made and, oh, how long they take to make, those surprises are, oh, 18-month decision cycle. Oh, boy, can we survive that long? How much money will it cost us to survive that long? All of those pieces fit together. And so the questions start with, do you know what you're into?
Yeah.
Do you really get what you're talking about here? Or do you think it's just a good idea?
I think there's a lot of times where an entrepreneur will have an idea and say that, oh, it'll work for this industry and that industry and that industry. Or if they say, okay, who's your customer? And somebody turns around and they say, financial services. Well, that's not a customer. That's a market opportunity. But who is, like you said, who is the buyer? Who is the influencer of that buyer or decision maker? And that's something tough I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't think about is sometimes your champion, which could lead to a purchase, isn't necessarily the decision maker. So you have to think about how that process, and I think I learned a lot of that from you.
Oh, wow, that's nice. Thanks. Thanks. Yeah, it's funny. I had a conversation with another entrepreneur yesterday, and it went something like that. Well, you know, these guys say blah, blah, blah. And I said, but they're a recommender, right? Of course they love it. They're going to tell people about it, but does that get you a decision? Does that get a buying decision from the person they recommend it to? What do you have to do to get to reach that person directly and tell them your value proposition? And how do they make those decisions? So when you're talking about industry, it's not just, you know, financial services, but it's there are categories within financial services, and there are categories within the category that you're in, and there are big competitors in those spaces, and how do you get there? And sometimes your customer isn't really who you think it is. Your customer might be the vendors that are already in that industry. Maybe the best strategy is to be acquired. Maybe you should be trying to figure out how to find a gap in what they do that your little thing can fill and get an early exit without ever having to have more than one or two pilots to prove that it works. So there are all kinds of ways to think about it, but it has to start with, do you really get what you're into? Do you really get what the dynamics are? Do you really get how you're going to reach the economic buyer of what you're doing and how they're going to make, what drives them to make a decision?
So as you've been in the startup scene and you've seen acquisitions and you've seen companies grow, and where are you at in the startup world now? Like, what are you up to now?
The company that I started with a couple of co-founders last year is a company that is focused on helping organizations of all types, mostly commercial enterprises and mostly not in the United States, sort through how to deal with long life.
Okay.
So it's called Economy 4, and it's called that because there really are four stages in life that have been kind of not talked about. They were up through like this the 18th century, but we have codified the idea of old age to a point where we've assigned a numeric value to it. And it has to do, and so we talk about silver, aging, longevity, retirement, all that sort of stuff. When the fact is, yes, we've got aging societies all over the world, but people are living longer lives today, all of them. Like, you guys both have young children.
Yeah.
Who will probably live to be 120 or 140, somewhere around there. You'll likely live to be 100. Science and technology has advanced that far. I'm 59. I can tell you that our family history is people who lived into their 80s and 90s as far back as the 17th century. So likely is I'll live that long too. Not that I'm saying I'm loving that idea, but yeah. But the fact is we haven't figured out how to deal with it in society and in business.
So is this anti-aging approach to this? Or what is your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I love that you said that. Because no. and that's the funny part, is that we, because society, we codify the idea of age as a byproduct of trying to build social safety nets for the industrial era, for the industrial period, which was to say we no longer worked in, you know, kind of multi-generational family businesses and farms, and moved to cities to work in factories. And you're from Pittsburgh, you know exactly what that's all about. And what we did was sort of dissipate the world and sort of consolidate people, but into working for others. And working for others means you might be labored long and hard, but you have to figure out how to take care of somebody then if they don't have big expanded families and kind of everybody having a role in family. So what we did was started in Germany actually, but the institution of things like Social Security and pension schemes that were, whether private by companies or public by governments, to say we'll take care of people if they reach an age, if they live to an age, we'll talk about living to an age, where they can't work anymore. So it was as much as anything about disability, but we codified it to age. And in some countries, that retirement, even mandatory retirement by government, is as low as 60.
Holy moly.
Yeah, so that would mean I'd be required
mandatory.
Mandatory.
You just turned 60. Sorry, turn in your tools.
Turn in your badge. Yeah, exactly. And that's and now you're on a pension and you're elderly. So the socially, now this is an interesting thing, because, you know, today, and you guys see me here with my gray hair, I hope that it'll turn completely white here really soon, because that would mean I'm matching a lot of young people walking around the world who are dyeing their hair white or gray. Gray is the new blonde. I don't know if you know that.
And that was a really interesting thing. Lily and I, this is David, we just had lunch, and we were walking down the street, and there was a guy, and if I had to speculate, he probably was late 20s, maybe early 30s, and he had his hair dyed completely gray. And Lillian, what did you ask him?
I said, hey, because I say it all the time. Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Yeah. Why? Why the hair?
And what did he say?
And his answer was, so that nobody will notice when I start getting older.
That was a pretty profound, interesting comment.
This is kind of like, you know, and you won't remember this, but in the 80s, guys started shaving their heads so nobody would know they were bald. But now it's okay to shave your head when you're bald, so, you know, whatever. So it got normalized, right? That idea of being bald got normalized. Being gray will soon be normalized too, but this is kind of part of what's happening in the world, this occurrence of understanding that people who are living longer lives generally, even if they aren't genetically predisposed to it, are living different lives, taking more kind of action about who they are and where they are, especially if they have some socioeconomic means. And all over the world, there's this emergence of people who are saying, wait, I'm still middle-aged. You know, some people will say 70 is the new 50 or that kind of stuff, but no, 70 is the new 70. It's that's the reality. And there are still, you know, I was on a customer support call for a company, and I'm talking to this woman, and we're having a chat, and I'm asking her some questions, and she's responding. We're talking about hearing aids, actually, because I happen to have a family issue with hearing, and so I had gotten hearing aids, and I was saying something like, wait a minute, my Bluetooth is not working right. I'm not picking you up right in my hearing aids from talking on the phone. And she says, oh, I just got hearing aids. And I was like, oh, that's great that you, like, you know, like me, you got them while you're young, and you're not going to lose more hearing. And she said, oh yeah, you know, it's about cognitive decline. This is what the new studies say, is that you can, cognitive decline is closely associated with hearing loss. And so if you can stop hearing loss, which is what happens when you get it fixed early, then you can defer cognitive decline. And she said, and that's why I do it. And I said, well, that's awesome. You know, this is what I do around the world, blah, blah, blah. And she said, you know, I wouldn't normally say this to a customer on the phone, but you're talking to somebody who's 81. And I was like, you rock. You're awesome. You're the woman I'm trying to talk about because you're just ordinary. It's not because you're extraordinary. You're ordinary, doing ordinary things. And then she proceeds to tell me her 83-year-old husband works full-time too. And she's clearly in a call center. You can hear all the stuff in the background. But she's helped me change my password, change my address, do all kinds of things without a question or a pause.
So it really comes down to the capabilities and lifestyle that you have and the health that you have. Age, really, your true age, and you probably know way more about this stuff than I do, of course, but your actual birth age is different than your physiological age, potentially different than your mental age, maybe. And so this, it seems like you're waving the flag over this movement. And so how would you describe, what is the movement that Economy 4 is trying to tell the world?
That life is about stage, not age. Just put a couple of letters in front of those last three, and what you have is a new way, actually not a new way, a way that projects backward in time to what was considered a four-stage life in centuries past, that this, you know, recent history of 150 years or so has torqued our thinking into a place that isn't relevant any longer. It's like the longest bubble you ever saw. And now we're emerging from it and need to emerge from it. So every company who's thinking about their workforce and shortages in their workforce needs to be rethinking, should I be talking to somebody about whether it's time for them to retire or not? You know, when a cosmetic surgeon says to you, one of the three top reasons that people come to them, men in particular, about face work, mm-hmm. is because they're afraid that someone around them, people that work around them, will believe that they're nearing retirement age, that they're too old. Mm-hmm. So as we rethink workforce, as we rethink who's got the money, guess who's got the money? People over 60. Mm-hmm. All the money.
Mm-hmm. So what's the business model in Economy 4?
So we work as go-to-market strategists for companies who are rethinking this. We work as workforce consultants to help them focus on how to rethink work policy that's not about what someone's age is, because someone at 62 could be at exactly the same life stage as someone 26.
You mentioned that a lot of your customers are actually in other countries. So a lot of times I think when you're, like for instance, when you're a college student, you come up with ideas that are for college students, and you know, being an American citizen, a lot of times you would think like, hey, I'm going to start, even in my hometown, like I'm going to start where I'm at because that's what you have access to. But you guys took an approach that you're going in other countries. What was the rationale behind that?
A lot of it has to do, it's kind of like healthcare, right? So healthcare is way simpler in other places than it is here. So sometimes that's easier. The decision making and processes for understanding that the economy in those places is shrinking. Take Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, China. China now has more people over 65 than there are U.S. citizens. 300+ million people over 65. So a rapidly aging society that's trying to figure out how to continue growth. Countries like Japan that are shrinking, their economy is literally shrinking because there are not new children being born. The childbirth is on the decline everywhere in the world. You guys are going to qualify because it requires 2.1, your wives, excuse me, because it requires 2.1 children per woman in the world to repopulate the same level. We're headed to a population decline, not incline. So we don't have to worry about overpopulation. Not going to happen. Birth rates are down even in places like India and other sort of underdeveloped or developing nations. Brazil, 20 years ago, the average lifespan was 50. Today, it's 70. That's a rapidly aging society. Countries outside the U.S. are panicked over this. We're not so much. We're a slow-aging society, and we're, you know, a very consumer-centric society. So we're not worried about this at the same level that other countries are. We should start being worried about it.
And that goes back to really understanding the market and understanding where the pain is, who has the most pain, and not going to what's convenient for you just down the street. And even in your business career, you've globetrotted quite a bit, and you've been to many different countries and traveling.
Yeah, that's and yes, that first point, exactly right. If you can beat your head against the wall and try to figure out how to get somebody to buy what you're selling, or you can figure out who's got the problem and go sell them what they need, which is, I think, the kind of bottom line there. But yeah, a lot of time around the world, and I've been so fortunate to be able to work lots of really interesting places and really understand culturally what's different about us and appreciate, you know, appreciate being American, but also appreciate the differences in the world and what it probably takes for us to all survive in this world, which is understanding each other more, not excluding each other more.
What about the sales process when you're in these other Asian countries or wherever your target customers basically are? What are the differences in the cultural business aspects in the sales process when compared to America?
Wow. Well, different for every country.
Sure.
Wow. And you know, the UK and New Zealand, like, radically different. I think that you have to sort that out just like you do the market. So what is it you're trying to get done? Where can you get it done? Who needs to get it done? And then what are the cultural contexts that make it possible for you to do it where you're headed? So it's market.
Sure.
Same question.
So earlier you mentioned, and this is something that you said was pretty important to you, is talking about people in their stage, not age. And you also mentioned, like, finding team members, especially, you know, like, as you're building. Do you think that it's important to look at your team members or your co-founders in terms of stage, whether what kind of business stage they've been in versus what kind of age? Like, do you think that's something that you pay attention to?
Wow, that's such a great question, Josh. Yeah, so I think the most important thing about, for me anyway, the learning has been you have to understand deeply what others' competencies are, because you can have a great idea together. I'm not a solo starter. I've never ever done a solo start, and I know people who do and manage to bring teams together and often reconstitute those teams over and over for whatever's next, regardless of the industry. They know each other and know every capability so well, they just rock. And I've only done a couple that had the same people, but, you know, have worked with the same people over and over again in kind of, you know, don't take the whole crew, but kind of same people over and over again. So it's stage is the most important thing for someone in what they want. And it's a question that I ask every entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. What do you, and teams in particular, what do you each know what the other wants from this personally?
Yeah, one may want an exit, one may want a lifestyle business, one may want to pass this on to their kids.
One may want to change the world.
One may not care about the profit, an impact. So that's interesting. So stage, in terms of business stage or mindset stage, could be, what do you want from this, right? Where are you at in this? Because, you know, you may decide that you want to retire sooner, or you may want to be in this for longer.
Or you want to do the next thing.
Or you want to do the next thing.
I just want to do this quick because I got another one.
Yeah, so I think this life stage versus age is a really important mission that you're on, kind of encapsulating that. And you said that there were four. Could you kind of give us, or you said that might have been four, like, in the past? I don't
know. Oh, yeah, four life stages. In past history, even you can go back and look in literature from all over the world around this, there was a concept of 100-year life, just as there should be today. We don't think about it that way, but the concept of 100-year life was, if you didn't die as a infant, if you didn't die as a child, if you didn't die of famine, if you didn't die of war, then that was actually what created the numbers for life expectancy, was people dying young, not people dying old. Mm-hmm. So the illustrations that go back even as far as the 15th and 16th century that show a 100-year lifespan and people like on the decline around 70 or so. So, you know, we think about it that way. But the four stages of life, even in that context, and even considered in places today like Singapore, there's a third age university. This idea of childhood, young adulthood, later adulthood, and old age. So we miss this kind of third stage with the codification of Social Security and those sort of pension ideas, was this notion of ages of dependency. So the bookends on adulthood were the age of dependence of 0 to 15 for childhood, mm-hmm. and 65 and over for old age.
For dependency.
And those terms are still used in measuring demographics around the world, age of dependency and the dependency ratio. So life, like productive life, was only considered in this 15, like, because kids went to work at 15, right?
So once you hit 65, no longer productive, and you're dependent on someone.
Isn't that blow your mind thing? It is, because that's the way we began to measure it. And the problem with the measure is it's now institutionalized in our own minds. Even people who are 50, 60, 70, 80-year-olds pretty often just go, psh, are you kidding me? fear that I am getting old. And so what do? We color our hair. And by the way, it's a bias.
Yeah.
Because people will say, you're older. I think I told you the story, Josh, about walking into see an entrepreneur in a Starbucks.
Yeah.
And literally a rocket scientist. And what do I know about rockets? But okay, cool. So I'm walking in to see this guy, and I was running late. I sent a text that said I'm running 5 minutes late. I walk in and I go over to the counter and pick up my coffee and say, oh, do you have anything? And when I get back with my coffee in my hand, he's looking at me. He's looking at my gray hair. I could see it, and saying, did you order? Literally, he said, did you order that before you got here? And I said, well, yes, wouldn't you? So, yes.
You know how to use a smartphone?
Yeah, exactly. Right? Do you text?
Yes. I asked you that jokingly one time, right?
Yeah, that was very funny. So it's those kinds of things, though, in our minds.
Yeah. Could I ask you a question for... This is a question. I'm 37. My dad is 72. And my dad has so much energy. He loves working. And he feels like he's created work, and he still wants to work. For what do you call it? The
third age.
Third age. What advice do you have for entrepreneurs who maybe have retired or left their business, maybe exited, and they're still in that third stage? Like, what advice do you have for them?
Oh,
we even interviewed someone. They've exited their business, and I go, what do you have next? And they're like, well, we're going to explore some passions. But what advice do you have for those people?
Oh, wow. Well, I'd first say, that's a great one. I would say stop thinking about your age and start thinking about what you really want. There is an MIT study in the recent past, and I actually did a LinkedIn post about this because it concerned me about Orlando, frankly, first-time tech entrepreneurs over 50 in Silicon Valley are 3x more successful than their 30-year-old counterparts in terms of valuation, in terms of scale of the company, even if they're a first-time entrepreneur.
Wow.
Wow.
Why do you think that is? Just experience or?
Yeah. Well, knowing the industry deeply, understanding every nuance and crevice. And even if they're a part of a team, not necessarily as the founder, but as a part of an entrepreneurial startup team, that contribution of experience and understanding lends so much more to how to get growth faster. So what I would say to people who are they're just exiting, or they're thinking, and this is part of stage, I'm financially comfortable. I'm not planning. A guy recently said to me, my financial planner called me and said he wanted to start talking about, you know, my retirement plan again. And like, and I'm trying to tell him, I'm not thinking about retirement. I'm thinking about what I'm going to do next. And it was funny because I saw a Fidelity advertisement on television just that night. It was a guy saying exactly the same thing. I was like, see, so there you go. My friend is 67. And he's, I'm just thinking about what I want to do next. I haven't decided yet. So I think that for those who are looking at their stage and where they are, thinking about being an entrepreneur for the first time is an interesting idea. Finding a team that you want to do something great with that you can contribute to if you're not the individual starter is a great thing to do. There are places and organizations in this town in Orlando that can, you know, go be a mentor at Starter Studio. Go be a, because every entrepreneur on the planet wants somebody's wisdom. And if you're looking for fun and excitement and enthusiasm and energy and stuff that feels like you're really giving back and you're getting something back, go spend time with entrepreneurs who haven't done anything that you've done yet, and you will start to get a reward back from that.
And that is valued. That is deeply valued. I've had conversations with older investors, and I ask, you know, like, why don't you get, you know, mentorship, or I just don't feel like I'm relevant anymore. I don't know how to use this or that. And, you know, what I'm hearing is the exact opposite. Is the experience is extremely valuable. The wisdom, the life, the knowledge of how to navigate these marketplaces is unparalleled because of the experience and deep knowledge. So you're saying get back in the game, get in there and dive in with these young entrepreneurs. They need you, they value you.
And not even young entrepreneurs, I would say, is entrepreneurs that aren't at the stage that you're at.
Yeah.
Or don't know what you know. Yeah. So this is where the teaming comes. But there's an opposite effect to that too, which is the reverse mentoring that happens. The things that you learn from others that you would never otherwise have known. So the part of the big return on time invested, whether you ever do anything with them officially or not, but the things that you learn, the things that you begin to understand, the relevance that you begin to get from that is all new and always exciting.
And keeps your brain active and you stay sharp instead of that decline when you're not exercising.
Well, so they'll ask you to be careful because most of us are not declining. That's the real tricky bit about this ageism problem, right? It's the only bias you can cover up in the drugstore. Literally, you can go change your hair color like for $12 in the drugstore, and people will look at you differently and think differently. But we naturally assume things like decline and lack of relevance and all that kind of stuff. And actually, because society has put that on us, a lot of us who are in third stage are actually putting that on ourselves. And it does, in fact, impact our health. So you can either rage against that and go work out every day. Like I know, I can't even tell you how many folks now who are at Orange Theory every day working their tails off sorry, I don't know how this gets broadcast. No HBO here. but not to say I'm raging against it, but to say I am who I always was.
Yeah.
I am as good as I will ever, I'm not as good necessarily as I'll ever be. I can still keep working at all the things I aspire to before. I'm on the ascent. I'm not on the decline. So I'm just at a different stage where I get the opportunity to see things differently. And that is what we as third age folks have to start taking on board ourselves.
I do want to ask a question about, it seems that this is systemic, excuse me. So this is a problem and a kind of an infiltration that has went into the way we measure things. It's ingrained in the way in our ads we see and the way we interact with people. And when you brought up earlier about the indicators and they didn't have a way to measure it. So it seems like reshaping the way that you actually do measure value, regardless of age, is like, how would you change that in terms of how would you change the system and the way you measure those types of things?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So in some of the stuff we think about in our firm, in workforce, for example, the way is not to go at a company and say, you need to rethink your retirement policy. And I've seen companies do this literally, exactly in opposition of even national policy, which says this is a retirement age. They've said, we don't have one. We're stopping that. But what really is important is to stop thinking about a meter on this. Throw away the markers that use age, because we didn't. There was a time in history when you didn't know anybody's age because it didn't matter. There was no stop start. You know, we institutionalized policies and things like that because we had to. So, you know, child labor is an example, right? We use an age as a marker. But now, if a 12-year-old is in college, we don't think much about that. Is there a marker for what age you should go to college? Is there a marker for what age you should graduate? Not so much anymore. Is there a marker, so 0 to 15? Let's think about the number of people who are 26 who are still living at home. So age of dependency, oh, and on the health insurance benefits of their parents. So age of dependency, it's not 0 to 15, is it? So throw away the markers. Look at things like company policies for workforce that say, let's say that work-from-home policy is not designed to attract millennials. It's designed for all people. It doesn't matter what age you are or what stage you are in your career. That idea of 26 and 62 being interchangeable in many cases is true. At 62, if your kids are off the payroll, God bless you. I hope that happens for you someday. It has for me, and I love you, my son. So the idea that a 62-year-old would be willing to exchange status, ladder climbing, career advancement, amount of money they make for freedom. I'm looking at a picture of a beach on the wall here. That could be Tahiti. And so working from a beach as a marketing person or a technical writer or even a coder from Tahiti is something that a lot of 62-year-olds are thinking about. Their 26-year-old counterparts are too. But just think about the number of solutions and systems that are designed to address millennials and Gen Zs that are saying it's all about them and what and the freedom that they want to be a digital nomad, when in fact there are probably more third agers who are interested in being a digital nomad and, by the way, can't afford it.
Yeah.
So it's rethinking and reshaping the ideas that categorize us by numbers and markers and saying, if all people are given the opportunity to do more and be more, they'll take it in the way that is best suited for them. And it doesn't matter how old they are.
Yeah. I think as we near the end of this interview, I want to give you a choice. You could either share, and you could even say option C, which is none of the above. Option one, I want to hear a success story of someone in that third stage who's just rocking it. Like that hearing aid lady who, at 81 years old, teaching you how to, you know, reset your passwords. I thought that was fantastic. So option one is you could kind of maybe share a story that you know to inspire us and the audience about the third stage people out there who are rocking it. Option B is maybe what question should I have asked you or David should have asked you that we just totally screwed up and we didn't ask you. So which one do you want to go down?
Oh my goodness. That's a question. So I'm trying to, of course, here I am. I thought about Shirley as that woman's name. She came to mind right away. I'll tell you the story of an entrepreneur you should probably interview, who's right down the street here and starting
Perfect.
His, I think, third company.
Heck yes, I love it. All right, let's go with this.
So I don't know how old he is. I'm not going to tell you his name because I'm going to tell you later, and you're going to call him and ask him to be on the show. But he's a geek and I think started out in. You know, some of the local industries, and then ended up doing a healthcare solution and managed to parlay that into something that's working very well. And I think he exited that one and he's just started another one that's another kind of whole different matter. But by the way, inspired by his own situation. And it was, okay, why isn't this done? And figured out not only how to build the technology that allows those who have those kind of organizations who have the problem to solve it, but also built and patented a security black box. So the whole system is just a plug-in black box for how you distribute health data, which is unheard of. It's just completely unheard of, particularly in that particular
segment. So he's a third stage entrepreneur here in Orlando who's on his third business.
I think it's his third company, yeah.
Rocking and rolling in it. So maybe this is a good question for the audience.
And self-funded, by the way, because now he can be, right?
So that means he's not handcuffed to investors or anything.
No.
He makes the decision and it starts there.
Yeah.
So that's the awesome thing.
But starting with his son, this one.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to start some businesses with my kids. I think it would be so much fun.
I could see you both doing that.
Yeah, I might do that. My daughter goes around knocking on doors with me in our business.
Ah, so that's very fun.
She's six, so she's knocking it.
That's
same name, two L's though.
Two L's, I gotcha. Well, I love that there are people named Lillian who are young.
Yeah.
And that's a funny age thing, because
she's in stage one.
She's in stage, totally stage one.
So
stage one could be fun again.
Lillian, where can people go to find out more about you and connect with you?
Definitely LinkedIn.
Okay.
I think that's the super easiest way, and it's Lillian.Myers, or it's just Lillian Myers, I guess.
And we'll put it in the show notes so
people
going through.
Yeah.
And then, so this is something to the audience, and then I'll actually let David kind of wrap it up and close. But for those in the audience who may be third stage entrepreneurs, we would love to hear your story. We would love to be inspired by what you're doing. So I encourage you to reach out to Lillian or any one of us. Share your story with us. Like, let us know, hey, I'm a third stage entrepreneur, rock and rolling on my fourth company, first company, second company. I'm about to start a company. We want to hear your stories. So David, why don't I pass the baton to you, and you can wrap it up and close this
Absolutely. We just want to thank you, Lillian, for joining us today. We thought it was a great dialogue, and the idea of stage, not age, is going to stick into, and we're going to start trying to ingrain that in our world today. And thank you for all of your wisdom and lessons that you've taught me over the years with go-to-market and startup and getting out there and asking why and asking all the right questions and navigating. And I'm sure a lot of the other entrepreneurs listening have enjoyed it. So until next time, we will see you on the next episode.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.